shit.
I don't know.
Welcome, members. You all are far more bright and serious than I am. We had a very late meeting last night, so we hope to go outdoors today. And they heard some of the CPA and Greenwater Park things, so it was just good.
Probably because that wasn't so fun.
Welcome to DNR this morning.
Madam Chair, good morning. Would you like to just start where we left off?
Yes, please.
All right. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. I have with me this morning Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of the Division of Fish and Wildlife. We left off on the bottom of page. You should have a new spreadsheet, I think, today. And what we're going to do is, after we're all done, I can just give a whole compiled copy of this to the committee in case you don't have your copy. So we'll get that out to people and get an electronic version out to folks as well, so you have that. But what we're going to work off of today is Fish and Wildlife moved to ecological... I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
No, I would just... is the Senate working off of these sheets, too?
Madam Chair, no, but we are providing that to them. In the Senate, we did... presentation similar to what we did in here for 08-09, but of course it was 10 and 11, focusing just on performance outcomes and change items.
Mm-hmm.
So I can give, what I'll do is I'll make sure that you all have a copy of the Senate presentation, and they have a copy of what we have. We've been working, the responses that I get, I've been trading off, giving them to the Senate and the House, so you guys all have the same information, trying to, and also all this stuff is on our website as well. So.
Super. Thank you.
All right. So we're on bottom of page one, the sheet that say final 310-09, and we left off with the gray wolf, well, we ended with the walleye stamp discussion. I don't think we need to go back to that, but so we're on the gray wolf change item, and with that, I'll turn it over to Ed Bogus to discuss that.
Madam Chair and members, Ed Bogus, Division of Fish and Wildlife, DNR, and the gray wolf initiative would provide for $220,000 a year in 10 and 11 from the non-game account in the Natural Resources Fund for research and monitoring, population estimation, a five-year post-delisting monitoring that's required by the Fish and Wildlife Service, and a cost share with the USDA Wildlife Services Wolf Control Program. Since the late 70s, the federal government has done wolf damage control when wolves kill livestock in the state. That's normally a cost share program, but because wolves have been federally protected since 1973, or actually even before that, under the Endangered Species Act, that program has been entirely federally funded. Just a little bit of background, because this was in the news over the weekend, that wolf delisting has been kind of on again, off again over the last few years. They were protected, like I say, under the Endangered Species Act of 1973 as endangered. They were reclassified in Minnesota to threatened in 1978, and that's when the current wolf depredation program started. They were delisted in March of 2007 and were actually under state management until September of last year. Over the last 6 months or so, they've actually been back on the federal list. The reason they were relisted was because of a D.C. District federal court finding that the Fish and Wildlife Service didn't follow all the technicalities that they needed to follow when they did the delisting rule. There was no finding on inadequacy of management or of a population or a biological need to relist. The Fish and Wildlife Service announced in January that they were going to publish a new delisting rule. That was delayed with the new administration because the new administration wanted to review all pending rulemaking. And then last Friday, the new administration announced that they were proceeding with this rule, that it's based on science. In fact, the delisting criteria had been established long before even the previous administration. So they've announced their intention to publish that rule. It will, we don't know what date it will be published yet, but the wolf will again be delisted 30 days after that rule is published. Of course, there's still a chance for additional legal challenges to that. expect probably a likelihood of that, but these provisions in this change item would help the state to fulfill its obligations as state manager of wolves. There's no questions on that. I'll move on to the next strategic objective, which is habitat management. In this objective, the general fund reduction is $1.6 million. The overall reduction across all funds is 3.5%. And the reason for that is that we're building back some effort into this objective. We're shifting reallocating some of our existing effort from population management into habitat management through the Game and Fish Fund, and this is primarily to do more intensive work on public lands and waters, WMAs, AMAs, shallow lakes. Moving into the change items on habitat management, we're proposing to reduce grants both for shoreland and for working lands type grants. We are proposing to increase efforts with technical assistance for shoreland so that overall our effort will be similar, but it will be more technical assistance and less grants. We're also under this proposing to reduce private lands cost share, and I think that that covers most of the changes under this. You can see in the right hand column there some of the current effort, how many miles of shoreline and acreages and so forth. And then there's also a change item here for clean water legacy, where fishery staff would reallocate time and effort to clean water efforts in FY11, and they would complete 100 full lake and or stream surveys in targeted watersheds. These would be watersheds identified by PCA. We have staff that's out there doing other work that has boats and scientific expertise to do the types of sampling, and that will allow for 100 additional full lake and or stream surveys that are related to PMDL development and clean water. That's the bulk of that. There would also be some time in that change item for fishery staff to work on restoration and protection plans for water bodies that are high value recreational or high priority recreational fisheries. And then also some technical expertise towards from fisheries towards development of TMDL plans in watersheds, in 8 watersheds in 2011. And there, our objective would be not only to address impaired waters, but those that are trending towards impaired status that through some watershed habitat efforts, we may be able to keep from becoming impaired.
Before you go on, are you finished with that section?
Yes, Madam Chair.
I'm going back up to the top here where you have 1.3 million acres of WMAs, and you want to get 700,000 more. How many of those acres have been restored to good quality habitat?
Madam Chair, I can't give you an exact answer to that today. We're currently asking our staff to go through a comprehensive evaluation of the need that's out there. I can tell you that all of the new acquisitions we're building into the acquisition itself, the money needed to do the high-quality restoration and bringing those up to a standard, but we have a backlog. I know that for the next 4 years we had identified specific projects on WMAs and roadsides that related to prairie management, where we had a 4 year need of about 13,000 acres for restoration and 127,000 acres for enhancement. The enhancement is primarily tree removal and prescribed burning, but We are addressing that need as we go on new acquisitions. We have a backlog that we don't have a good inventory of right now.
Okay, and I'm glad to hear you're doing the restorations on the new acquisitions. That's good. On the backlog, it seems to me we need to have some sort of sense of a time frame here to that we could get the job done in restoring these this acreage. And of course, this is something in my judgment, and I'm going to ask about yours, that the new heritage dollars those monies could be used to restore this. Am I correct about that?
Madam Chair, yes, that's our understanding. In fact, we've got some pending proposals that would do just that, that are so far receiving favorable response in the Heritage Council.
And what do you mean by favorable response?
Well, they're on their preliminary list.
Okay.
Still. And yes, we've gone through a pretty extensive GIS exercise to get all of the boundaries and cover types identified on all the WMAs and get those on the website. The piece we haven't completed is the current status and management need on all those different cover types that are on the existing WMAs, and that's the next step that we're asking staff to do, and certainly the availability of the new legacy funding has accelerated in our mind the need to get that inventory done. So that's part of what we hope to, I don't know if we'll get it done over the next year completely, but we'll certainly have a much better grasp of it within the next year.
It would be good if we were on a plan that would be finished within 25 years, it seems to me. Is that your goal?
Madam Chair, yes, at least within 25 years, if not before. And the other thing that we have is that we've developed a web interface for the public if they see problems on WMAs that need attention, that they can alert us through the web to that too. So, but our staff, you know, we have a lot of WMAs and we have staff with multiple county work areas, and so they aren't always at every WMA, on a regular basis. So that also will help us to identify some of the more gory needs that we.
I mean, it does seem that we know, or at least science tells us, that high quality means better habitat, which is probably better for our hunters and fishers. So if that's the case, we may not need to have as much land because we have higher quality land. Would that be a fair statement?
Madam Chair, it's certainly true that the better the habitat, the more production you can get off of a smaller amount of it. So yeah, that would be true. And we are harvesting seed from WMAs to restore other WMAs and from prairies. So our goal is to establish high-quality habitat and to use what we have to build on to improve the remainder.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just want to bring to the committee's attention, you do have a one-page fact sheet outlining all of our clean water legacy activities for the Division of Fish and Wildlife, Ecological Resources, and Waters. This clearly identifies the major program elements and key measures and outcomes for each of those activities that are there. We talked a little bit about the IBI testing here in Fish and Wildlife, but we're going to do ecological resources next, and we'll focus more on the clean water activities in that division. And then we've talked about the water pieces as well. So this one-page document kind of brings all of those proposals together for you.
Just help me out on one thing. Are we seeing any cuts in any of these elements in the governor's budget, or is this additional or new money?
Madam Chair, these activities will increase the activities we have been doing. The funding for these activities, for most of them, were funded with one-time dollars for the past several biennium, so there was no base for that. The recommended funding in the governor's budget is using the Clean Water Legacy dollars.
Okay. But we have been funding these things.
Yes, but this is where we get into this difference of opinion. But it was always on a one-time basis, with the assumption, at least from my participation within the G16 and other groups, that this type of funding, if it was ever enacted, would become the funding for these types of activities.
Okay, I'll move on, Madam Chair and members, to the technical assistance objective building block. This is where we provide technical expertise to individuals, organizations, and agencies on wild fish and wildlife issues. And in this area, there's a general fund reduction of $832,000 overall. Sources of funding, it's a 4.3% reduction. Proposal here is to reduce farm bill assistance. Some of our watershed planning, private lands work, that's kind of the one-on-one type work. We're going to shift our effort from the kind of one-on-one with individual landowners to more efforts training other people that work with private landowners, SWCDs, NRCS, other organizations that work with private landowners that may not have the fish and wildlife expertise. We feel we can multiply our efforts more efficiently by offering them training and materials that address some of the fish and wildlife technical issues. The informal type environmental review, where we're commenting on projects, we'll do less of that type of work. And I think that pretty well covers the technical assistance piece. Moving on to outreach and department programs. This is a variety of programs that we're reaching out to various communities that may be underrepresented: recruitment, retention, use of volunteers, education. And this area has a general fund reduction of $228,000. Overall funds, it's a reduction of 5.8%. Here we're going to do less stocking in some of the fishing in the neighborhood ponds, less production or purchase of catfish for stocking those ponds. We're looking at the Minnesota Shooting Sports Education Center in Grand Rapids as trying to find a new model for operating that. We are exploring options that could include leasing. We're looking for grants. We may go to more user fees. We're exploring options to do capital investments in the facility to potentially convert some of it into office space. Also, we haven't ruled out sale of the building and the property if those options don't pan out.
Excuse me for a moment. Representative Clark has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at some of the outreach and supporting programs that you're working on there, and the multicultural group that you're trying to reach, can you talk a little bit more about that? And particularly, I see the stocking of the ponds, the fishing in the neighborhood, and so on. Is that fishing in the neighborhood safe for? I have a lot of immigrant constituents, as do many other folks here, and they're fishing all over in the lakes and streams, and I'm just thinking, I'm not sure where the fishing in the neighborhood ponds being stocked exactly is occurring, but do we know about the safety of the eating of those fish in terms of the mercury and other pollutants that are in them, and are they being warned? I mean, we did have a requirement the State Health Department was supposed to post signs that indicated when there were serious contamination in those, and I'm wondering how you interface with them and how is that related to this? And I'm glad you're doing the outreach. I just want to know whether people are being advised.
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, we do work closely with TCA and Health on mercury advisories, and we have that information available on the website. I can't, I don't know here this morning if there's on any of the ponds that we're stocking for the fishing in the neighborhoods, if any of those have advisories that have to check on that and get back to you.
If I could even know where they are, do you know offhand where those ponds are?
Well, there's about 50 of them in the Twin Cities metro area. They're small wetlands and ponds that are stocked so that the fish are, you know, they're very popular. They receive very heavy fishing pressure. If we didn't put fish in there, they would quickly be fished out. So, and we're netting and transplanting some of those fish from other areas. We're also raising some fish for stocking in those, and we're purchasing some fish for stocking. But I don't know the extent of testing or the level of mercury that might be involved, so I would have to get that information.
Thank you. I like that. It's not just mercury. We know we have PFCs in our city lakes. We have a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole gamut of contamination of fish that are really an important part of the diet of a lot of folks. I'm glad people are using the ponds, but I want to know if they've been tested, and if they have, and they find issues, that they posted in various languages.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'm wondering, Mr. Bogus, if you know, and this is because of Representative Clark's comments, if you know that, and not so much the ponds, but the lakes, the metro lakes that may be impaired or have something wrong with them, and we know that there's a lot of people that are eating a lot of fish out of those, and I don't know, they might not be ones that you're stocking, but can you tell me who would be responsible then for putting up a marker that would say, for instance, eat only so many of this fish in this metro lake because of these pollutants?
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, again, I'm not sure who would be responsible for that type of posting or how much of that is done. We certainly provide information in the fishing regulations and on the website. I'm not sure on the posting of specific water bodies. I'm going to need to check into that, see if that's being done, how much it's being done, who's doing it, those types of things, because I don't know off the top of my head.
And Ms. Chair, as a follow-up, could you get us that information so that we can understand better what that might be? And I'm just thinking of the Phelan chain of lakes, because there are so many people fishing in great numbers and eating the fish. And I'm just wondering about notification for those people.
I understand that Director Hirsch has more information on this question.
Madam Chair and members, Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological Resources Director. And Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, in general, the strategy for notifying people about fish contamination issues has been that the Department of Health puts out an advisory. In years past, it used to be more specific to individual lakes, but the problem with that was that it was a reflection more of the lakes that had been tested, and so I think what they've done more in recent years is to put out general consumption advisories by species and size of fish, and then depending on the category, for example, children and women of childbearing age tend to have more restrictive fish consumption advisories, but I think in general the booklet, it's based on the booklet that the Minnesota Department of Health puts out, and I don't think we actually put out, you know, signs or markers on individual lakes, because it's more of a general consumption advisory now.
Chair, we used to have a law that required that. Has a law changed?
Sorry, could you repeat the question, please?
Thank you. We used to have a law that required posting of our fishing lakes, or I remember by one of the dams where there's a lot of fishing. You could see the posting about in various languages, only eat X amount of fish. Since the situation's actually gotten worse, and there are some lakes for which no fish should be eaten by children or pregnant women, period, ever. Until they, probably shouldn't be eaten by adults either, but at least the most vulnerable are being warned. But it was a law that there be posting that. Has that changed?
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, I don't recall the specific law that required that, so I don't think I can answer that.
Okay,
that
maybe we can check on it. Thank you.
All right. Moving on then to public information and customer service. There's a general fund reduction here of $832,000, overall reduction across all funds of 10.3%, and we're just not going to be as responsive to the public just because we're going to have fewer staff. We're working, one of our strategies is to consolidate offices where possible, and we're also reallocating the time of the remaining staff, so there's going to be just a slower response to some of the personal contacts, or fewer personal contacts than what we've been able to provide in the past. So that's the last strategic objective. There's also, this shows the treaty payments that are made. That's a pass-through, basically, that makes payments to the various tribes through the settlements that have been negotiated over the years and ratified by the legislature. And that completes the Fish and Wildlife change item.
Members, are there questions? Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize if you stated this earlier. I'm just looking at the National Archery in the Schools program. And do we get federal dollars for that, or... I see that we got about $1.3 million for the entire program. That includes the fishing and neighborhood, but where does the remaining money come from?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, we are not getting, I don't believe we're getting any federal money for that program. It's money from Game and Fish Funds primarily at this point that's supporting that program. It's a national program because it was developed, initially it was developed in a few states and then was taken nationwide, and it's been a very popular and growing program. That number of schools involved has really been increasing, and we're starting to see a lot more interest from other schools. We're having a national statewide shoot, and there's a national shoot, but it's all state funded. I'm not sure of all the sources of funding, but I'm pretty certain there's no federal money coming into that.
Madam Chair, we're spending as a state $4.6 million then on the entire outreach and department programs, and that includes the National Archery and the Schools program?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, that the Archery in the Schools program is one part of that. It's certainly not the major part of that. This includes all of our statewide outreach and all those programs that are listed under supporting programs.
Madam Chair, would it be possible to get a detail of, how much are we in this little section of the outreach and department program? How much is going for each of the individual items that are within that? So we know how the $4.6 million is broken out, and then also find out what are all the sources of funding for it.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I think we can do that for at least those major programs. And the 4.6, I would just point out, was the current biennium, and this coming biennium we're planning 3.9. So,
mm-hmm.
But we certainly could break out some of those major programs like Minocqua, Archery in the Schools, Becoming an Outdoor Woman, Fishing in the Neighborhood. We could give you a breakdown on those.
That would be great. Thank you.
Any
any other questions? I don't see any other questions. Thank you for that.
Madam Chair,
I think go on to the next.
Thank you very much. We're going to move on to ecological resources now. And I'll bring up Director Stevehurst once again. This is an area within the DNR governor's budget recommendations that does not have any reductions. It has actually change items related to clean water legacy, Madam Chair. So we can either focus on that. I think what I'd like to do is just have Director Hurst run through really quickly the non-game, the lakes and rivers, focusing on the clean water, ecosystem health, and an integrated conservation information delivery system with the emphasis on those clean water activities, if that works for you, Madam Chair.
Depends on what the members say.
Good. We'll start.
Why don't you start?
We'll start that way and see where we go. Director Hirsch.
Madam Chair, the first strategic objective is non-game and rare resources, and this includes our programs in natural heritage, which is plant ecology and listed species, scientific and natural areas, which also includes our native prairie programs, non-game wildlife, and county biological survey. That's about a third of our budget overall projected for the next biennium. The strategic objective for lakes and rivers has a number of different programs in it, including aquatic plants, both survey and helping to coordinate the statewide permitting program, non-game fish sampling, aquatic invertebrates, stream habitat protection and restoration, Mississippi River management, lake habitat protection, and then the clean water legacy. And I'll focus on the clean water legacy change items a bit. We have some different areas highlighted on the spreadsheet. One is the index of biotic integrity monitoring to assess priority lakes, and this is basically a sampling of non-game fish populations as a biological indicator of water quality and ecological health. It's something that we've been doing for a couple of years now, and we would continue with the one-time funding, as Mr. Meyer mentioned earlier. And we would continue in the next biennium. We have collected data.
Are you actually spending more money than the one-time money, or is it the same money?
Madam Chair, it's about the same. Let me just check here quick. Here it is, Madam Chair. We spent in fiscal year 08 about $270,000. In fiscal year 09, we plan on spending just under $200,000. And then the plan under the governor's rec would be to spend $205,000 in fiscal year 10 and $391,000 in fiscal year 11. And in that fiscal year 11, then we would actually be meeting the PCA goal of getting to all the lakes on a 10-year cycle. Continuing, Madam Chair, with the clean water legacy, we also have the activity for expanding our fish tissue mercury monitoring. We currently collect samples for both mercury and PCBs on about 70 lakes a year statewide. With the clean water legacy funding, we've been able to increase that by 80 lakes for a total of 150 lakes a year. And the clean water legacy sampling is focused just on mercury. And we've also got the development of a watershed assessment tool. And this is basically a GIS-based tool that helps us establish baseline conditions in a watershed. It can be a very valuable tool for the total maximum daily load or TMDL planning, both in helping to establish baseline conditions, but then also once you implement the TMDL plan, to helping to monitor the watershed and determine if some of the corrective actions that have been implemented are actually having the desired effect. So we think that this will be a very, very valuable tool as we go forward with TMDL planning. And then we also, it's not mentioned specifically on the spreadsheet, but we have hired our regional specialists in each of the four DNR regions to help with TMDL planning with PCA and local units of government to provide ecological resources, technical expertise in the TMDL planning process.
Representative Purcell has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. in the regard to the fish contaminant work that you're doing. I didn't hear you say dioxins. Are you doing dioxins anywhere?
Madam Chair and Representative, no.
You know you have some.
It's Madam Chair and Representative, we've got, you know, there are a number of contaminants, and the ones that we're doing regular analysis on are PCBs and mercury, but we know we have other contaminant issues as well.
That would add, Madam Chair, that these endoxins do add to the toxicity of information you're going to put out there. One other question, do you know if you're doing PCBs as aerochlores or congeners?
Madam Chair and Representative Park, I didn't catch that. I don't think I know the answer, but...
I'd appreciate it if you'd get back to me on that.
And what was the specific question?
Your analytical work on PCBs, is it done as aerochlores or as congeners?
I think one of the general concerns is that we are testing for pollutants that we knew about when the Clean Water Act was enacted in the 1970s. And I think the Index of Biological Integrity is great, because that is really the big time outcome, you know. And so I think that is just super. But to just choose mercury, we know we're going to find mercury in fish. I mean, it seems like an exercise at this point, when we could be looking at other pollutants that might be more descriptive of what's happening to our populations. Are we getting stuck in the wrong paradigm?
Madam Chair, I don't know that we're in the wrong paradigm. I certainly agree that there's other pollutants of concern. I think the idea behind the mercury testing is that the mercury TMDL is going to be a big part of the Clean Water Legacy Act in addressing the mercury TMDL. And so having good information on mercury concentrations in fish tissues will help to address that. It is a major, even though you're right, there are other contaminants that are of concern. It's very widespread. Mercury is very widespread, including in the northern part of the state and lakes that we typically consider to be pristine. And it is an issue that we're trying to get a handle on in terms of atmospheric deposition and release of mercury to the air. So I think the main idea behind it, again, was to support the mercury TMDL planning process.
If you were to choose the top three other contaminants that you would be concerned about, that would make our lakes unhealthy, what would those be?
Madam Chair, I don't think I'm very well qualified to answer that question. I think, you know, I would need to consult, or the committee would need to consult with somebody that was more well versed in toxicology, and maybe perhaps somebody from the Department of Health. We could certainly ask that question of the right people and get back to you on that.
Well, don't you think it would be worthwhile for us to know what other things out there that we should be thinking about that might be a problem with our lakes? And maybe they turns out not to be, but if they turn out to be, shouldn't we be catching that now rather than waiting for it to, so that our Index of Biological Integrity says, uh-oh?
Madam Chair, certainly, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if you would find out what if folks were to look, what would they be looking for? Okay. Other questions from members?
I would just offer to you, sir, by my consultant on that might be Deb Swackhammer.
Madam Chair, if there's no other questions, I'll continue then to the next. Our next strategic objective is ecosystem health, and this is about 29, almost 30% of our budget, and the biggest piece of this strategic objective is our invasive species programs. You can see we've got indicators for a number of water bodies with zebra mussels, number of new infestations with Eurasian water milfoil, and we also have outcomes on the number of watercraft inspection hours we do, the amount of enforcement effort that we're putting towards invasive species, and just also mention that we have added regional invasive species specialists to each of the DNR regions to help provide more technical assistance on a local level in that program. This also includes the fish contaminant work that we have been doing prior to the Clean Water Legacy Act. As I mentioned, about 70 lakes a year. And this has been focused, again, on mostly on mercury and PCBs. And then this also includes our fish pathology lab, where we do fish disease testing for the state fish hatcheries as well as private fish hatcheries and also for wild fish populations. The last strategic objective we have is for integrated conservation information, and the biggest piece of this is our environmental review and wetlands monitoring program. And we talked a fair amount about environmental review when we were going over the 08-09 budget in front of this committee, so I won't repeat any of that information unless the members want me to. We have a couple of wetland monitoring projects going on right now that I think are of interest. One is to get at whether we're achieving the goal of no net loss, and this is a statewide monitoring program where we're doing aerial surveys and randomly statistically sampling areas of the state to get a handle on what is there for wetlands now, with the idea of repeating that. It's to do the entire state takes 3 years. We finished the first 3-year cycle, and the idea now is to repeat that each 3 years and start to get a handle on whether the state is actually achieving the goal of no net loss of wetlands. We really didn't have a good way of doing that prior to implementing the survey. And then the other thing that I would mention, just that's being funded right now by LCCMR dollars, is an update of the National Wetlands Inventory, where we actually go to a specific area and update all the wetlands that are existing in that specific area. That's sort of a quick run through of the programs, and I can certainly go into more detail or answer any questions if need be.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed in the outcome description section of the chart, Ecological Services has worked on 3 mining EIS projects. Could you tell us what 3 projects those have been, and what the status of Ecological Resources work is on those 3 EISs?
Madam Chair and Representative Onsfeld, yes, I can. We're currently working on EISs for Polymet, which would be the first copper-nickel mining project in the state, and then 2 taconite projects, CTAC and Mesabi Nugget. And we're the farthest along on Polymet. We have actually put a preliminary draft EIS out for agency review last December. We're still working through some issues with that EIS related to issues of some of the water quality projections and some of the safety issues with the tailings basin dam. And we are working very hard on that as we speak. We've got a plan to meet later this month with the contractor that's writing the EIS and the management folks from PCA, DNR, and the Army Corps of Engineers to go over the outstanding issues and try to determine how we can address those and get to the point of being able to notice the draft EIS.
If I may, Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. Can we expect that Ecological Resources work on these 3 EISs will be complete in this calendar year on these 3 mining projects?
Madam Chair and Representative Onsfeld, I don't know for sure. That's certainly the goal. But what happens with these EIS projects, and Polymet is a very good example, is as we get into the EIS, we discover ways that the EIS becomes a bit of a discovery process, and we discover ways to improve the project. And both the company and the company's contract and the cooperating or the RGU the agencies. And when we do that, it requires additional information. It requires additional data analysis, and so it becomes very difficult. I know there's been frustration with the time frames, particularly with PolyMed, and that there seems to be delays. But each of these delays is making the project better in terms of being able to address the potential for significant environmental effects and then being able to address adequate alternatives and mitigation measures. And so the problem with it being too schedule driven is you can get yourself into a situation where, sure, you can notice an EIS, but it tells a very unhappy story, and you don't want to do that because that's not good for the agencies, and it's not good for the company. It's not good for any of the players involved. So I realize there's frustration, again, with the pace sometimes, but the idea is to have a defensible EIS. That's really what the agency's goal is, and that's what we want.
You're spending $10 million in this unit. Now, it's my understanding that the EIS that Representative Ansel referred to, you're reimbursed for that work. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
If you're reimbursed for that work, where are the other expenditures in here? Are there some of these EISs that you're not being reimbursed for?
Madam Chair, we're reimbursed for all of the EIS work. The other expenses that we're not reimbursed for would be formal environmental review associated with work on environmental assessment worksheets. That would be both EAWs, where we're the RGU, where DNR is the RGU, and EAWs, where another unit of government is the RGU, but we're providing input or comments on the EAW. There's also what I would call informal environmental review. I think Commissioner Meyer referred to it at the last committee hearing as the big E and the little E, but we review a lot of different environmental documents for power lines, pipelines, permits that we put into the environmental review category. I think it just says on the spreadsheet, but in a typical year, and this isn't unusual, we reviewed over 1,000 documents or we plan on reviewing over 1,000 documents in the current year, and that's been a pretty typical number over the last couple of years, particularly as we've seen the upsurge in energy projects, pipeline projects, biomass projects, and so on.
Are you reimbursed for those? For that, obviously you're doing environmental review for your own project. That would be just bookkeeping, or for local governmental units. That's a different thing. But what about when you're doing 5 power plants or 5 oil and gas pipelines? Are you reimbursed for that work?
Madam Chair, generally no, we are not. Occasionally we have cost shared with the company to get an additional person on the ground to help provide the feedback on the alignment. But in general, no, we're not reimbursed. The only exception to that I know of is there was a law, I think, passed recently that allows us to be reimbursed for large appropriation projects where we're doing an EAW. I think pretty much most in Division of Waters, but we, you know, it does span out into some of the other divisions, including Ecological Resources. But in general, no, we're only reimbursed for the EIS work as a standard practice.
This is a pretty hefty amount of money that we are spending for EAWs when they're not. I mean, there is no breakdown here, but if you took out what you're doing for local units of government and you took out what you're doing for your own, you know, EAWs, what you have to do, what's the dollar we're spending when we're doing the informal review for the other things or EAWs for other folks? Do we have that breakdown?
Madam Chair, I don't. When we had the previous committee meeting when we were going over the FY08-09 budget, I did a breakdown for the committee of the EAW costs when we're the RGU, because we can break that out. When we're not the RGU, I can get you the costs
for the combination of EAW and permitting review, but I can't, because of the way our class code system is structured, I can't break out what is EAW review and what's permit review, but I could get you the cost for our in general for our work when we're not the RGU for those categories.
Would that be helpful to members?
I think it would be. It's my name. Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hirsch, this is back to the wetlands part of this, we were still on the wetlands part of it. And you're talking about the aerial photographs that we've done and all the work that we've done, all the sampling, so we know which wetlands are not there anymore. But then you say because it has no direct influence over most of the state wetlands, DNR by itself will not be able to achieve the overall no net loss goal. And in my mind, the outcome should be to restore the wetlands. So I'm wondering, when you do all this photographing and documenting, then who you give that to who would achieve the outcome of restoring the wetlands?
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, I think the outcome of restoration is really a shared outcome, and I think agencies, DNR is involved, I think Bowser is certainly involved, PCA is involved. We did have a wetlands working group that we put together last year that looked at strategically, how can those three agencies coordinate their wetland restoration goals better to start to try to achieve multiple benefits? Because in the past, DNR has tended to look at waterfall, PCA has tended to look at water quality and so on. So we're trying to coordinate that better so we can look at multiple goals. The idea behind the survey is just to give us the information. We know that there's wetland restoration going on. We also know that there's some wetland loss still going on, either due to illegal activity or some of the de minimis activities that can take place under the Wetland Conservation Act. So the idea behind the survey is just to tell us, are we at least breaking even, or is the restoration work actually adding? But the actual goal of restoring wetlands, I think, is nested in the program in those agencies that I mentioned.
And thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Hirsch. Then can we be notified of what the outcomes have been, which outcomes have been achieved as far as restoring wetlands? Because it seems a little nebulous, because we talked to Bowser, we talked to PCA, but the actual outcome of restoring the wetlands, we really don't have a measure, because we don't always have all of you together in the same room at the same time with that goal in mind, with that outcome in mind. So I'm wondering how we would do that, and could you report that to us of your activities?
Madam Chair and Representative Scalzi, we can look into that and try to see what we've got for information.
Representative Clark.
Madam Chair, in looking back on the environmental review question, one of the areas that you're looking at is the impact of high voltage transmission lines, and I see the target is, it says no target set. The long term desired result is to minimize loss and degradation to habitat. Do you have a summary somewhere of what you're finding for that particular issue? Some way we can know about that, what you're finding, what the impacts are. If there's no target set, I'm wondering how you measure it.
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, I'm not sure that we do, and you're speaking specifically about the high voltage transmission lines now.
Well, you mentioned that you worked on those issues, numerous high voltage transmission lines, including the one that you cite. So if you worked on it, you must have some data.
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, when we work on them in an environmental review context, generally what we're doing is we're taking a look at the specific alignment and trying to make sure that that alignment isn't going to cause damage to critical habitat, listed rare and listed species. I don't know that we actually try to have a specific outcome that says that so many acres or so many different species protected. What we try to do is modify the alignment if necessary to avoid those kinds of impacts. So I'm not sure if we would actually have the type of summary that you're looking for.
Madam Chair, what kind of impacts are you looking for? from high voltage transmission lines.
Well, Madam Chair, what, and Representative Clark, what you'd be looking for example, is the corridor going through a habitat type, is it a rare plant community that we really don't want to lose because it's not very well represented in the state? Are there threatened or endangered species that would be destroyed by that power line, by the development work that takes place to put it up to clearing and so on? Those would be, you know, two I think big examples of something we would look at. And then, you know, once we did that, then we would look at, are there alternatives? Can we reroute the line? If we can't reroute the line, is there a mitigation measure? Is there some specific, for example, if it's a listed species, can we look at another area that we could protect or add to for that listed species to mitigate for that? But typically we would be looking to try to avoid, if it was feasible, to try to avoid alignments that would impact those species or those rare plant communities.
Okay. I think I'm being very clear. My question is, what impact are you worried about? What is the kind of impact? What's the nature of the impact that you're worried about? Are you talking about putting in some holes in that construction causing the problem? Are you talking about voltage from, you know, that from the lines? What is it that you're actually looking for in terms of any sort of damage or degradation of the...
Madam Chair, Representative Clark Codger, if I understand you right now, it's the physical impact to the actual development, the disturbance to the land, that impact the natural resources that we would be looking at.
So there's not any long-term look that you do of the impact of those lines in those areas?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I didn't quite...
I'm just wondering if you're looking at any sort of long-term impact from high voltage being in those areas, or if you're only looking at, you know, you put this hole in the ground and it disrupts a certain spot in the wetlands or whatever. I'm asking if that's the limit of what you're looking at, or are you looking at impacts of high voltage in that area as well on those species?
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, the DNR, I believe you'd be referring to health impacts from high voltage, human health impacts.
Actually, you said that you're limiting it to habitat, so I was looking at habitat, but either would, of course, be important to know, but just in terms of habitat, what you do look at.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Clark, I don't know that we would look at the actual impact from the voltage itself on the habitat.
Thank you.
Any other questions for members? Don't see any.
Madam Chair, thank
you. There will be more, however.
Not a problem. We're going to move on to the Division of Forestry now. And you'll see this starts on page 6. The total budget for the Division of Forestry estimated is $1,137,637,000. And it's important to realize, as we talk about the Division of Forestry, most of these dollars are for boots-on-the-ground type jobs, for people actually working in the fields, out in the woods, doing the work. And I just want to come back and talk a little bit about the economic stimulus question that Representative Anzeld had previously. I went back and we did review the activities we are working with the divisions of the rest of the executive branch on the economic stimulus package. We're directly working with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, U.S. Forest Service, on a proposal that would allow us to increase our carded or our certified firefighters throughout the state. We're waiting to hear back on that, but if we are successful in that, it will provide job opportunities immediately for many of the people in northern Minnesota to participate and to become carded and be able to fight fires. The other pieces of it, we're working through the agencies, Department of Commerce, for example, trying to determine the energy efficiency dollars that are available for us to update our facilities. Solar, geothermal, windows, doors, things of that nature. Our economic stimulus coordinator is Joe Kristinka. Many of you have met him previously. He's working with the rest of the executive branch coordinators to determine where we will be eligible. There may be some trail dollars as well, but I want to assure you that we're doing the best we can to make sure that these jobs are being created, that we're creating green infrastructure where possible with these packages, and that we're taking full advantage of the stimulus dollars that are out there right now. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn this over to Director Epperly. There are several fact sheets you have in front of you that we're going to be working off of. The first one entitled Forest Management Activities, FMIA. This is the first change item we're going to talk about. It's a reduction in the forest management investment account and also a general fund change item increase.
You talked about the federal stimulus package. We've been looking at it, too. If you find money for trails or for energy efficiency that can be used by public agencies, please let us know about it. The only trails we could find were ones that would be associated with transportation projects.
That's what we're looking at, too, Madam Chair. But I will keep the committee abreast as to what we see. It is still a work in progress. There is so much information to go through, and we're doing the best we can coordinating at the state level through the coordinator, Tom Hansen, and all the other agencies' leads to make sure that we do have the ability to take full advantage of this opportunity.
Representative Fortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on that, maybe offline, if you can let us know about your communications with MnDOT for their trail prioritization process, because I know they have a list of trails that they're planning to fund with the stimulus money, and I wasn't sure about the interaction between DNR and Metro Council Parks and MnDOT to determine the priorities. And I'm keenly interested, and I know my constituents are too.
Madam Chair, I will make sure that you're updated on that.
Yeah, I think that would be a good thing to put on our schedule, to have a short update on that, either Thursday or Monday or whenever you can get that. Is that all right with committee? Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You skipped over the fire management thing, but I did read that there were some federal stimulus dollars dealing with firefighter training, and I don't know if you've checked into that, but I think I even got a card at my home that says firefighter training under the federal stimulus package is available. Is that something you've been checking into?
Madam Chair, it is, and that's what I was referring to. It's our wildfire firefighters that would go travel throughout the country fighting fires as they come up. There might be a different program that's talking about metropolitan firefighters as well that I'm not aware of, but we're talking about, the technical term is red card. Having the red card, it allows you to be able to go to a federal fire, to go to California, wherever these fires are going to come up and participate in those activities. They are fairly good paying jobs, and one that, you know, if history holds true, there will be a need for once again this summer. So,
thank you. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the Commissioner. Did we get reimbursed for the Ham Lake fire? Has that all been cleared off the books and all of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Jones, yes.
And Madam Chair, how much resource, a general idea of the resources that were put in there in dollars? And what we got reimbursed.
Madam Chair, Representative, we'll have to get back to you on that actual number. I don't have that available with me right now.
And one last follow-up. Do you, in the reimbursement process, do you trade out with the federal? So if we end up going and using our resources, if the federal ends up coming and working on state fires, then do you guys, you know, swap that, or do you just bill it out, each side bills out, and you pay each other?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, we could get the actual number for you on which occurs, but generally we have fire management agreements, but typically if the fire is within the U.S. Forest Service boundaries, those are fully paid for by the U.S. Forest Service, and our expenses are then reimbursed if we fight fires there. Similarly, if we employ federal help on state fires, it's the same type of mutual agreement.
Would you please put your name on the record?
Yes. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Dave Epperly, Director of Forestry, Minnesota DNR.
Thank you.
Last question.
Yes. Representative,
thank you for your indulgence. Let's say that you had a fire on a very large industrial landowner's property and you responded to that. How does that all fit into the reimbursement of, pick one of the big four?
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, as any private landowner, we would be responsible for the suppression, and the cost would be absorbed through our budget. Depending on how the fire started and if it occurred, if it was a man-caused fire, then we would seek reimbursement through that process. But typically, we pay for those and expect that comes directly out of our budget, and recover costs where we can.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. Wouldn't a private landowner have insurance against fire? Or do they? I don't know the answer to that one for sure.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I think it's available, but I think it's highly, highly, very expensive, and I don't think many, if any, people have it.
Thank you.
Representative Lilly, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Assistant Commissioner, last week, Denny McNamara and a few others and myself were had an opportunity to go out to Anderson Windows, so I hope when you're talking about putting some windows in places with the stimulus package that you consider using Minnesota manufacturers, and they've got some great products out there, and we need their jobs, so buy Minnesota.
Madam Chair, we will make sure that we buy an equal number of Anderson and Marvin windows if we get to that point.
Fair enough.
I think you want to take that back. We have other window manufacturers.
Exactly, Madam Chair. There are other considerations to take in this place. So, just quickly, while we're on the topic of fire, you can see that this block does represent about 30% of the proposed expenditures, estimated at $44.5 million. The general fund portion of that is estimated to be $36,400,000, which includes the fire direct and the fire open. And of that, the open, which is a unique concept for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is $22 million. We budget some money in the general fund budget, but then there's also an estimated amount in an open appropriation for when, if and or when the situation arises that large fires come up. The department has the ability through some workings with the Department of Management and Budget and other things to act to access dollars within this open appropriation. Firefighting is our number one priority during the fire season. The protection of life and property changes the work we do when these issues arise. Our forces will go, our firefighting forces, our workforces from forestry, from enforcement, from fish and wildlife, parks and trails. We mobilize where we need to go to protect life and safety and property. So it does change our work, and you do hear about it, and you do notice it when the fire season is strong. So that's why these dollars are there. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn this over to Director Epperly to talk about the performance or the estimated budget expenditures and then the change items as well.
Okay, Representative Dill has a question.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And could you remind us, when you do use the open appropriation, do we reconcile that in the deficiency bill, or how does that get reconciled after you make the expenditures?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, we'll have to get back to you on that. I'm not sure if there's any legislative reconciliation of that. It's budgeted, and we can talk with you to make sure you understand how that's done, but I don't have the specifics of it right here with me. I know it's not carried in any bill, so to speak, but I just need to confer with finance and our fiscal people.
Thank you.
You want to continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just by way of discussion, we talk about forest fire management, state land asset management, and our CFM program as our general priorities that we focus on. And in the order of priority, they're listed. Fire management being the top priority, that is a have to type of situation. We must fight the fires. And secondly, then, is the state land asset management, as that relates the strategic objectives. We have in the Division of Forestry, we manage 4.5 million acres of state forest land for sustainable timber production, outdoor recreation, and wildlife habitat. Put another way, Madam Chair, that our job is really growing trees, and we look to achieve the revenues then through the harvest of the timber, that is really a final outcome of a series of investments from the past, and we look at after we harvest the timber as a new beginning, and that's where much of our investment goes to. So in that, focusing directly on the forest management investment account,
with the downturn in the housing industry and the general downturn in the forest industry, the shortfall of the forest management investment account, the change item in the governor's budget request is $2 million to offset that. And that is to help us keep the boots on the ground, people in the woods, setting up the timber for the most important aspect of the getting the timber set up for sale. So generally, that's what we're looking at in that regard. Obviously, the other element of reforestation, again, growing the trees, reforesting, very important for forest health, and many of the other elements that we do that are important work. Forest health being a combination of healthy forest for good, strong wildlife habitat, watershed protection, soil protection, and the like. Very, very important things. We look to reforest 18 to 22,000 acres artificially and another 10 to 12,000 acres. Actually artificially reforest another 10 to 12,000 acres with natural regeneration of 18 to 22,000 acres. Very important work. The protection of those resources after we plant is ongoing. The protection to keep the trees growing in an optimal way from everything from browsing to making sure that the trees that we plant aren't being outcompeted and that the trees that we planted are meeting the objectives that we planted them for. So in general, in a very broad look at that, so that's the important work of state land management. Moving down in the supporting program.
Madam Chair, I just need to bring your attention to this, to the fact sheet here and the FMIA reduction. This is probably one of the most significant areas within the governor's budget that we have drastic impact within this, within the whole department. Last biennium, or this current biennium, we've unallotted approximately $5 million in the forest management investment account. The governor's budget for fiscal year 10 and 11 requires an additional unallotment of $5 million in 10 and $6.1 million in FY11 in order to make this account cash flow. So we're taking out $11 million from the forest management investment account, which was established approximately 2005, I believe, as a way to help diversify the forestry's budget. Previously, the receipts went into the general fund off of timber harvesting. We've developed, with the support of the legislature, a way to capture those receipts from not going to the general fund, but allowing them to go to the department to be used for actual forest management activities. It's created a huge impact right now, as you can see. What we're asking for to help offset this is $2 million each year. We're predicting, or we estimate, that the impact of the reductions will potentially reduce the DNR Division of Forestry workforce by 76 FTEs over the biennium. The new money, the $2 million per year, would allow us to retain 25 of those FTEs, so we would have a net approximately of about 50 FTEs that would be not in the Division of Forestry. Our hope is to manage these through attrition, through vacancy management, and other opportunities, but it does represent a huge potential impact to the Division of Forestry. We're trying to maintain, our goal is to maintain our work. You can see here under the impact, hold steady on our commitment to offer wood for sale by offering at least 8,000 cords or more, and protect investments in forest health and productivity. We also have a couple other change items that will relate to this, specifically the Forest Management Heritage Enhancement change item we'll talk about next, but I wanted to make sure we got that on the table before we moved off of this item.
When I look at the number of cords that are going to be offered for sale, I'm thinking about the economy. Are we going to be selling these cords of wood for far less than we essentially have in them?
Madam Chair, because of going back a couple of years when the timber markets were very high, timber stumpage prices were also high. We were in a situation where the timber prices were almost too high. It was good for the direct line to the budget. It allowed us to make. The state did well by receiving the income when that timber was harvested, but because of the downturn in the industry over time and because of the way we set our prices using transactional evidence, those timber prices have declined. And that is part of the reason for the reduction in the forest management investment account. So the direct answer to your question is yes, we will be selling the timber at a lower price. It's what the market can bear. We set and establish a minimum price, and then we auction that, and the market will bid that price up, if you will, to a higher price than the minimum, typically, if it sells.
Okay, but that wasn't my question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
My question was, are we essentially, given this economy, going to be selling wood for less than the cost we put into it?
Madam Chair, the direct answer is no. We won't be, but the prices are...
Why do you say that?
Madam Chair, because the cost that we put into our timber is... In setting up the direct amount, and we can get back into some of the semantics, but essentially it still shows that for every dollar we invest in stumpage or put into stumpage, it returns about $2.62 in sales tax revenue, and also the economic value added is up to about $40. So within that, our direct costs are recovered. The other element of this is, and I know we can, it's rather complicated, but it's hard to explain in just a few sentences. But remember I said that most of the investments we make is not involved in the harvesting of timber, it's in the growing of our forest. Those investments are recovered over time as we harvest the timber. That's how you recognize the revenue. And so it's not a direct relationship in any given year. And that's why I say, no, we're not going to be selling timber below our price. We are required to sell at market prices based on an appraisal.
I'm at a loss to see if the market prices are as low as they possibly could be this year, that we will not be recouping our costs. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is along these same lines. For the enlightenment of the committee, as Representative Guinness was questioning you, I thought that if you could, Director Epperly, tell us in general. Let's just pick a species that's so commonly harvested and sold, aspen, where we were 2 years ago on price and where you anticipate we're going to be where we are now on price. And I liken this to the precipitous decline in the stock market. And so we've talked about the forest management investment account and how that the revenues have gone down and the unallotments have been made and all of those things. But what we haven't talked about is where we were in real dollars per cord and how much we are today in real dollars in cord, so that people can kind of get their arms around this whole thing.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, 2 years ago the average price for sale price for aspen was around $50 a cord. Now we are advertising aspen for around $22 a cord and selling it around $28 a cord.
I think, Madam Chair, that's answered the question. It's pretty cheap right now. In fact, if I could, Madam Chair, I have another question. Seems to me that in around my house, a just exceptional amount of harvesting going on. Now, I'm not sure about the rest of the area, but right around the Boise Cascade Mill, are paper companies and the users of that wood, are they like people who invest in stocks buying it cheaper now knowing that it's probably going to be worth more in the future, or are they still just buying what they need? I mean, when I was on Snowmobile last weekend around the Boise Cascade Woodyard, and God bless them because we need to have the timber harvested and we need the people to work, but there is an exceptional amount of wood there. Are they buying ahead thinking that this is the bottom? Do you know? What is the strategy there?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I think that, you know, there are areas in the state and there are mills that are doing okay, even in this difficult time. The area you describe is one of those areas, and they are harvesting. They do have operations that are ongoing. They may have slowdowns at the mill, but they depend on this wood coming in, and so they are harvesting it, and that has a direct impact, a positive impact to our cash flow. They are doing it because of the fact that especially in the Northland, we go through a period of time where the roads have road bans. We can't get into the woods because the frost is coming out of the ground, and they do buy that wood ahead to try to get their wood yards filled for summer operations, typically when the orders and the demand begin to ramp up. And so you're seeing the result of that in how much wood is being harvested at this point in time. And yes, they're harvesting where they can afford it best and keep their costs down.
I am watching the clock for members. Given the prices right now, what are we going to receive for 800,000 cords of timber?
Madam Chair, the projections for that is in the neighborhood of $22 million total revenue for the sale of timber in a given year.
But given the prices right now, what are you expecting?
Madam Chair, that is what we are expecting. That is the forecast.
Okay.
One last question.
Representative Bill.
Well, thank you. The target has always been up in that neighborhood, 800,000 cores. Do you think that there will be the demand for that 800,000 cores, or is it going to be less considering the economic situation? And second question is, about 10 years ago, there were 4,000 Class C resorts in Minnesota, and today there's about 800 same type of resorts, maybe 900. Tell me about the logging infrastructure and what's happening to that, and when the industry recovers, what's going to happen then? I sense that every time I go to a gas station, somebody's telling me about selling all their equipment.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, the first part of your question is the I'll go to the second part of your question with the logging infrastructure. It is impacted. There is a reduction in harvesting, and those logging companies that are teetering are the ones that are having the trouble, and those are the ones that you're seeing selling the equipment. They don't have the deep pockets to be able to invest long term into timber and hold quite a bit of forest capital ahead of things. But to give you a perspective on the first part of your question, 2 years ago we were selling approximately 93% of all the wood we put up for sale. Today, we're looking at about 80% of the wood that we put up for sale, and the shift is towards those buyers that can afford to hold that capital and anticipate, using it in the future. So that's the difference. That 13% drop in what we sell or have been selling is the effect that you're looking at. However. Again, the wood is at a lower price. Some of the things you're seeing up in your neck of the woods is keeping people working, keeping people employed,
and so far we're not falling any further behind. Depending on how things go, another mill closure, that scenario could change.
Commissioner Jill?
No, I'm sorry to talk about all this here in the committee, but it's just something that we need to deal with. A lot of money, and there's a lot of things that we need to know. And you know, one thing that I'm here that begs the question, and I probably will get annihilated by industry, but you know, the law of supply and demand usually sets the price. And on the state end of this, we are interested in getting a realistic and fair value, but we're also interested in trying to incentivize that mills stay open. So I don't know. It just seems like when the supply dries up a little bit, it firms up the price, and when the supply is oversupplied, it lowers the price. And I'm not suggesting that we reduce the amount of wood that we are planning on harvesting, but it's something to think about, because you know, falling a lot lower will have an impact here, and as it would have an impact there at the mills if the price went up. And so I'm just trying to figure out how that all balances itself out.
Well, this is a good place to stop, and we're obviously going to continue this particular discussion on Thursday. Would someone be so kind as to move the minutes of March 5th? Representative Portman moves the minutes of March 5th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved, as and with that, we will adjourn the meeting.